Chapter 135. Enlightened, when Mr. Woodcourt arrived in London, he went, that very same day, to Mr. Vholes in Symond's Inn. For he never once, from the moment when I entreated him to be a friend to Richard, neglected or forgot his promise. He had told me that he accepted the charge as a sacred trust, and he was ever true to it in that spirit. He found Mr. Vholes in his office, and informed Mr. Vholes of his agreement with Richard, that he should call there to learn his address. "Just so, sir," said Mr. Vholes. "Mr. C.S. address is not 100 miles from here, sir. Mr. C.S. address is not 100 miles from here. Would you take a seat, sir?" Mr. Woodcourt thanked Mr. Vholes, but he had no business with him beyond what he had mentioned. "Just so, sir. I believe, sir," said Mr. Vholes, still quietly insisting on the seat by not giving the address, "that you have influence with Mr. C. Indeed, I am aware that you have." "I was not aware of it myself," returned Mr. Woodcourt, "but I suppose you know best." "Sir," rejoined Mr. Vholes, self-contained as usual, voice and all, "it is a part of my professional duty to know best. It is a part of my professional duty to study, and to understand a gentleman who confides his interests to me. In my professional duty I shall not be wanting, sir, if I know it. I may, with the best intentions, be wanting in it without knowing it, but not if I know it, sir." Mr. Woodcourt again mentioned the address. "Give me leave, sir," said Mr. Vholes. "Bear with me for a moment. Sir, Mr. C. is playing for a considerable stake, and cannot play without need I say what? Money, I presume?" "Sir," said Mr. Vholes, "to be honest with you, honesty being my golden rule, whether I gain by it or lose, and I find that I generally lose, money is the word. Now, sir, upon the chances of Mr. C.S. game I express to you no opinion. It might be highly impolitic in Mr. C., after playing so long and so high, to leave off. It might be the reverse. I say nothing." "No, sir," said Mr. Vholes, bringing his hand flat down upon his desk in a positive manner, "nothing." "You seem to forget," returned Mr. Woodcourt, "that I ask you to say nothing, and have no interest in anything you say." "Pardon me, sir," retorted Mr. Vholes. "You do yourself an injustice." "No, sir. Pardon me. You shall not in my office, if I know it, do yourself an injustice. You are interested in anything, and in everything, that relates to your friend. I know human nature much better, sir, than to admit for an instant that a gentleman of your appearance is not interested in whatever concerns his friend." "Well," replied Mr. Woodcourt, "that may be. I am particularly interested in his address." "The number, sir," said Mr. Vholes parenthetically, "I believe I have already mentioned. If Mr. C. is to continue to play for this considerable stake, sir, he must have funds. Understand me. There are funds in hand at present. I ask for nothing, there are funds in hand. But for the onward play, more funds must be provided, unless Mr. C. is to throw away what he has already ventured, which is wholly and solely a point for his consideration. This, sir, I take the opportunity of stating openly to you as the friend of Mr. C. Without funds I shall always be happy to appear and act for Mr. C. to the extent of all such costs as are safe to be allowed out of the estate, not beyond that. I could not go beyond that, sir, without wronging someone. I must either wrong my 3 dear girls or my venerable father, who is entirely dependent on me, in the Vale of Taunton, or someone. Whereas, sir, my resolution is, call it weakness or folly, if you please, to wrong no one." Mr. Woodcourt rather sternly rejoined that he was glad to hear it. "I wish, sir," said Mr. Vholes, "to leave a good name behind me. Therefore I take every opportunity of openly stating to a friend of Mr. C. how Mr. C. is situated. As to myself, sir, the laborer is worthy of his hire. If I undertake to put my shoulder to the wheel, I do it, and I earn what I get. I am here for that purpose. My name is painted on the door outside, with that object. And Mr. Carstone's address, Mr. Voles? Sir, returned Mr. Voles, as I believe I have already mentioned, it is next door. On the second story you will find Mr. C.S. apartments. Mr. C. desires to be near his professional advisor, and I am far from objecting, for I court inquiry. Upon this Mr. Woodcourt wished Mr. Voles good day, and went in search of Richard, the change in whose appearance he began to understand now but too well. He found him in a dull room, fadedly furnished, much as I had found him in his barrack room, but a little while before, except that he was not writing, but was sitting with a book before him, from which his eyes and thoughts were far astray. As the door chanced to be standing open, Mr. Woodcourt was in his presence for some moments without being perceived, and he told me that he never could forget the haggardness of his face, and the dejection of his manner, before he was aroused from his dream. Woodcourt, my dear fellow, cried Richard, starting up with extended hands, you come upon my vision like a ghost. A friendly one, he replied, and only waiting, as they say ghosts do, to be addressed. How does the mortal world go? They were seated now, near together. Badly enough, and slowly enough, said Richard, speaking at least for my part of it. What part is that? The Chancery part. I never heard, returned Mr. Woodcourt, shaking his head, of its going well yet. Nor I, said Richard moodily. Whoever did. He brightened again in a moment, and said with his natural openness, Woodcourt, I should be sorry to be misunderstood by you, even if I gained by it in your estimation. You must know that I have done no good this long time. I have not intended to do much harm, but I seem to have been capable of nothing else. It may be that I should have done better, by keeping out of the net into which my destiny has worked me, but I think not, though I dare say you will soon hear, if you have not already heard, a very different opinion. To make short of a long story, I am afraid I have wanted an object, but I have an object now, or it has me, and it is too late to discuss it. Take me as I am, and make the best of me. A bargain, said Mr. Woodcourt. Do as much by me in return. Oh, you, returned Richard, you can pursue your art for its own sake, and can put your hand upon the plow and never turn, and can strike a purpose out of anything. You and I are very different creatures. He spoke regretfully, and lapsed for a moment into his weary condition. Well, well, he cried, shaking it off. Everything has an end. We shall see. So you will take me as I am, and make the best of me? Aye. Indeed I will. They shook hands upon it laughingly, but in deep earnestness. I can answer for one of them with my heart of hearts. You come as a godsend, said Richard, for I have seen nobody here yet but Voles. Woodcourt, there is one subject I should like to mention, for once and for all, in the beginning of our treaty. You can hardly make the best of me if I don't. You know, I dare say, that I have an attachment to my cousin Ada? Mr. Woodcourt replied, that I had hinted as much to him. Now pray, returned Richard, don't think me a heap of selfishness. Don't suppose that I am splitting my head and half breaking my heart over this miserable chancery suit for my own rights and interests alone. Ada's are bound up with mine. They can't be separated. Voles works for both of us. Do think of that. He was so very solicitous on this head, that Mr. Woodcourt gave him the strongest assurances, that he did him no injustice. You see, said Richard, with something pathetic in his manner of lingering on the point, though it was offhand and unstudied, to an upright fellow like you, bringing a friendly face like yours here, I cannot bear the thought of appearing selfish and mean. I want to see Ada righted, Woodcourt, as well as myself. I want to do my utmost to right her, as well as myself. I venture what I can scrape together to extricate her, as well as myself. Do, I beseech you, think of that. Afterwards, when Mr. Woodcourt came to reflect on what had passed, he was so very much impressed by the strength of Richard's anxiety on this point, that in telling me generally of his first visit to Simmons Inn, he particularly dwelt upon it. It revived a fear I had had before, that my dear girl's little property would be absorbed by Mr. Vholes, and that Richard's justification to himself would be sincerely this. It was just as I began to take care of Caddy that the interview took place, and I now return to the time when Caddy had recovered and the shade was still between me and my darling. I proposed to Ada that morning that we should go and see Richard. It a little surprised me to find that she hesitated and was not so radiantly willing as I had expected. "My dear," said I, "you have not had any difference with Richard since I have been so much away?" "No, Esther." "Not heard of him, perhaps?" said one. "Yes, I have heard of him," said Ada. Such tears in her eyes, and such love in her face. I could not make my darling out. "Should I go to Richard's by myself?" I said. "No, Ada thought I had better not go by myself." "Would she go with me?" "Yes, Ada thought she had better go with me." "Should we go now?" "Yes, let us go now." Well, I could not understand my darling, with the tears in her eyes and the love in her face. We were soon equipped and went out. It was a somber day, and drops of chill rain fell at intervals. It was one of those colorless days when everything looks heavy and harsh. The houses frowned at us, the dust rose at us, the smoke swooped at us, nothing made any compromise about itself, or wore a softened aspect. I fancied my beautiful girl quite out of place in the rugged streets, and I thought there were more funerals passing along the dismal pavements than I had ever seen before. We had first to find out Simmons Inn. We were going to inquire in a shop, when Ada said she thought it was near Chancery Lane. "We are not likely to be far out, my love, if we go in that direction," said one. So to Chancery Lane we went, and there, sure enough, we saw it written up: Simmons Inn. We had next to find out the number. "Or Mr. Vholes' office will do," I recollected, "for Mr. Vholes' office is next door." Upon which Ada said, "Perhaps that was Mr. Vholes' office in the corner there." And it really was. Then came the question, which of the two next doors? I was going for the one, and my darling was going for the other, and my darling was right again. So up we went to the second story, when we came to Richard's name in great white letters on a hearse-like panel. I should have knocked, but Ada said perhaps we had better turn the handle and go in. Thus we came to Richard, poring over a table covered with moldy bundles of papers which seemed to me like moldy mirrors reflecting his own mind. Wherever I looked I saw the ominous words that ran in it repeated: "Jarndyce and Jarndyce." He received us very affectionately, and we sat down. "If you had come a little earlier," he said, "you would have found Woodcourt here. There never was such a good fellow as Woodcourt is. He finds time to look in between whiles, when anybody else with half his work to do would be thinking about not being able to come. And he is so cheery, so fresh, so sensible, so earnest, so everything that I am not, that the place brightens whenever he comes, and darkens whenever he goes again. God bless him," I thought, "for his truth to me." "He is not so sanguine, Ada," continued Richard, casting his dejected look over the bundles of papers, "as Vholes and I are usually, but he is only an outsider, and is not in the mysteries. We have gone into them, and he has not. He can't be expected to know much of such a labyrinth." As his look wandered over the papers again, and he passed his two hands over his head, I noticed how sunken, and how large his eyes appeared, how dry his lips were, and how his fingernails were all bitten away. "Is this a healthy place to live in, Richard, do you think?" said one. "Why, my dear Minerva," answered Richard with his old gay laugh, "it is neither a rural nor a cheerful place. And when the sun shines here, you may lay a pretty heavy wager that it is shining brightly in an open spot. But it's well enough for the time. It's near the offices and near Vholes. Perhaps, I hinted, a change from both might do me good, said Richard, forcing a laugh as he finished the sentence. I shouldn't wonder. But it can only come in one way now, in one of two ways, I should rather say. Either the suit must be ended, Esther, or the suitor. But it shall be the suit, my dear girl, the suit, my dear girl. These latter words were addressed to Ada, who was sitting nearest to him. Her face being turned away from me and towards him, I could not see it. We are doing very well, pursued Richard. Voles will tell you so. We are really spinning along. Ask Voles. We are giving them no rest. Voles knows all their windings and turnings, and we are upon them everywhere. We have astonished them already. We shall rouse up that nest of sleepers, mark my words. His hopefulness had long been more painful to me than his despondency. It was so unlike hopefulness, had something so fierce in its determination to be it, was so hungry and eager, and yet so conscious of being forced and unsustainable, that it had long touched me to the heart. But the commentary upon it now indelibly written in his handsome face made it far more distressing than it used to be. I say indelibly, for I felt persuaded that if the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.